W-T-E-N-E-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I am here with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. And you may have seen him and many of the others we've had on the channel recently. Like I was saying earlier, you know, it is so important right now that we've seen so many people get sucked in by the same old lie they told us about Iraq. Saddam Hussein has got weapons of mass destruction. We're going to do regime change. We're going to liberate the people. And I'm seeing some of the exact same people fall for this crap. So, Lawrence, you know, when you saw the news that Israel had attacked Iran, first off, what went through your mind? Was it deja vu? And thank you for coming and spending time with us.
To a certain extent, it was, because at the tactical level, as we would say in the military, this is all, I've seen it before. I've seen it up close and personal before. I've even seen some of the words Bibi Netanyahu, for example, in his speech that was just a demeaning speech, in my view. He used the very same line from President Bush's speech to the joint session of Congress in 2003 when we were getting ready to go into Iraq. He said, "We cannot allow the world's most dangerous regime to acquire the world's most dangerous weapon." That's a direct lift from Bush's speech. He didn't even have the gumption to write himself a new deception. We're doing the same thing again. We're doing it with a much different and challenging and dangerous situation too. This situation is ripe, as one person said to me this morning, for doing the final job of unraveling the American empire. I think the American people, to a certain extent, inchoate though it may be, intuit that, because the polls right now are showing a good solid 60+% majority want nothing to do with the United States and Donald Trump involving them in a war with Iran. And you look across the political affiliations and you see the higher percentages with his own Republicans. That would fall off quickly, probably, if Iran made the mistake of extending the war itself to attacking U.S. facilities in the region and killed American sailors and Marines and soldiers and airmen. And they're very defenseless. They're very defenseless because they're spread out across basically combat producing apparatus, not combat fighting apparatus. So you've got Al-Udeid in Qatar, you've got King Khalif in Saudi Arabia, you've got the 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain, you've got the largest reception and ongoing troop facility in Kuwait. These are all undefended. So if Iran wanted to, she could kill a lot of Americans. And that would change those polls dramatically, and then we would be in for a penny, in for a pound, I think. So I hope they don't make that mistake. Israel, on the other hand, might try to cause them to make that mistake, because Israel wants us in this war. Right now, Israel is going through an experience that since 1948 it has never gone through, unless you want to count the Ben-Gurion terrorists and others in the beginning who had killed British citizens in order to preserve their mourning state. They're in trouble. They're being pummeled by Iran. And I'm fairly confident that Iran has more missiles than they have counter missiles. So they're running out. And we are running out of missiles to give them, which is another strategic thought if you feel like we might have some other enemies in the world. So it's a situation that's fraught with possibilities, and some of them, and most of them, in fact, are really dire, but some of them aren't. If Trump has said what he said, mercurial though he is, that he's going to take 2 weeks, whatever that means, and in that time the Iranians decide, well, we've pummeled Israel enough to where we've taught them a lesson, and we go back to the negotiating table with Trump thinking he has newly gained leverage, we could come out of this with an agreement. And the agreement I would like to see is the one that they've been talking about, and that is where we take this little island out there and we make it the reprocessing facility, if you will, for the region, and everybody's uranium is reprocessed there and they share it. And at the same time, we recreate a nuclear weapon-free zone in that region. This is not a new idea. We had this idea in the Pacific Command out in Honolulu in 1984, 1985. That would be good, but you'd have to get Israel to join it and they'd have to give up their nuclear weapons. But I would like to see that happen. So there are some positive things that could come out of this, but they're outweighed entirely by the many negative things that could come out of it, one of which, of course, is a regional war. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is up here, come out of that tactical operational level into the geostrategic ether for a moment. The reason is the United States and its lackeys in NATO are attempting to create an arc of crisis that starts in the Arctic. We are really preparing to fight the Russians in the Arctic, down through the Baltic, where the Norwegians are testing Russia's patience by trying to interdict their shipping in the Baltic Sea, even though it's in international waters, down through Ukraine and the disaster we all know about there, which is principally our fault. It's not a war between Ukraine and Moscow so much as it is a war between Washington and Moscow, Ukraine being the proxy, and on down into Southwest Asia where now we're starting another crisis. This is all to arrest the inexorable shift of power away from the Western Hemisphere and back towards the East, where incidentally 2,000, 3,000 years ago it came from. And we're not doing a very good job of it. Call it the great game revisited with new parameters, new designs. But one of the things we're trying to do is create this arc of crisis to block China and its base road initiatives, one in the center, one in the southern center, and one in the south, trying to block them and keep them from coming into our hemisphere and dominating it the way they are increasingly dominating the Near East or the Northeast Asia.
The most common question we're getting asked is, what are the real motivations here? And we looked at the Grand Chessboard, Brzezinski's book, and he talks about Iran, China, and Russia forming an alliance, and that being the biggest threat to U.S. hegemony. Do you believe that is the main reason here?
Well, if you are doing that sort of thing, as Brent Scowcroft and George Kennan, before he died, and Henry Kissinger all said to Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State, the most stupid, idiotic thing the United States has done in the new century is not the global war on terror or anything associated with it. That was stupid enough. But the most stupid thing you've done is expand NATO. All three of these wise men said that. Or whatever you think about them, I think Brent's one of the smartest strategists I've ever met. And George Kennan was no piker either. Big mistake, but that mistake was made because we feared that this inexorable shift of power was taking place. And we saw it as an inimical shift, not one that could be accommodated, one that could be managed, one that we all could succeed in, that we all could profit in. And very importantly, one in which we all could work together to fight the two existential threats we all face: nuclear weapons without any treaties and a new nuclear arms race, which is just right now a warning, and the climate crisis. So they couldn't understand why we were so stupid, and Powell had no answer for them, really. I think he thought they were just old men pontificating. They weren't. They were telling the truth. Stupid to do it and to start off the cycle of events that we've started off in the center, if you will, of this arc of crisis, and now to try and expand it to include the Persian Gulf and Southwest Asia. We do not want to let China and Russia, Russia now, make any inroads into our territory, as it were. And let's just look at what we've done that was strategically stupid in our proxy war in Ukraine. We forced China and Russia together. There was no alliance there. In fact, there was every reason to believe that oil and water didn't mix, so to speak, that Russia feared that long border it had with China, always had, south of Vladivostok, were more Chinese than Russians, inside Russia even. and yet we've made Putin overcome that inhibition, at least apparently, and he's allied with Xi Jinping and Xi Jinping with him. So we forced this condominium of powers, if you will, that is now in a place where the power is going. I mean, if you've been through Central Asia lately, Tashkent, Samarkand, Dushanbe, booming. And clearly, you know, autocratic governments in most cases, but who cares if they have autocratic governments if they're beginning to take care of their citizens and to spread the spoils a little bit. Liberal democracy might not be the right answer for them. And that's another thing we've done. We've weaponized liberal democracy, and we're using it like we use Christianity in the Spanish Empire, the French Empire, the British Empire. We use Christianity and missionaries to go out and get people into the fold, you know, when really what we were after was filthy lucre. We were after riches. And that's essentially what we're doing today with liberal democracy in Georgia and Romania and other countries where we're trying to spread the empire, if you will. It isn't working. And I think we're getting somewhat desperate. I think you see that desperation registered right now with this administration.
And after religion came MTV and all things Western with the fall of the wall. All right, so who would you say?
How about that interview where Ted Cruz, Senator Cruz, admitted to Tucker Carlson that Genesis 13:2, I think, was his motivation for supporting Israel? Because if you support Israel, you're blessed. If you oppose Israel, you're cursed. Are you kidding me, you Princeton graduate senator? That's your rationale?
Do you think that he believes that, or he's just pretending to believe that?
I think he believes that. I really do. I think he does.
Wow. So who is more important to Iran right now? Would it be China or Russia?
Both are. I don't know if you know, but two of the most sophisticated electronics warfare ships that China has, hull numbers 855 and 815 Alpha, just pulled into the Persian Gulf. And one of the first things I thought was, wonder if the Israelis will attack them like they did USS Liberty in the Eastern Mediterranean in 1967, killing a whole lot of American sailors. I just don't think they'll attack a Chinese boat like that. But that shows you China's interest, and one wonders what those ships are going to be doing for Iran. And there's been, you know, conversations between Putin and Prezekin and also Arachi, the foreign minister, apparently about further help from Russia to include more S-400s and more of the frontline fighters they've given them. Interestingly, the new equipment training team was just finishing up with this first squadron, as I understand it, in Iran with Iranian pilots. And I don't think we've seen those in the air to any great extent. So I don't know if they've got them underground in hangars underground or bunkers or whatever. Maybe they don't feel competent to put them up yet. But that said, this war, such as it is, that's going on right now, is pretty equal. The Israelis stole a march, of course, cheated, did a Yamamoto on Tehran that we enabled them to do, did a Saddam Hussein on Kuwait, on Iran. Spies attack, international war crime. But it's looking like right now from the videos that I've been able to get my hands on and from commentary coming from Tel Aviv and from Haifa and from Jerusalem, it's looking like the Iranians are holding their own. Now, Israeli propaganda is not giving that message out, but it is there. And Israelis are undergoing something they have not in their lifetimes ever undergone. They're being pummeled. rich Israelis are going to the coast, hiring a yacht or taking their own boat and floating across to Cyprus or Greece or somewhere out of the fray. We saw Netanyahu run to Athens when it first started, and I understand he's deep underground right now. It's not necessarily going Israel's way. So now the question becomes, what do you do, Mr. Trump? If Israel is in some danger of even its state not lasting, it's killing Palestinians now at a fierce rate, 51 yesterday, 44 the day before that, 70, and they're killing them in this unconscionable way of getting them to collect around the feeding points and then killing them. So this just can't go on this way and have the United States continue its support and have Trump not lose a lot of the voters he's got. The polls right now show 60% across the board, Republican, Democrat, Independent, whatever, 60%. What else have you gotten 60% on lately? Don't want the United States in the war in Southwest Asia. So that, and if Iran were to suddenly start attacking U.S. facilities in the region, which are very vulnerable, that would change overnight. So Iran does not want to do that. And I think they know us well enough to know they don't want to do that unless they absolutely have to. They do not want to do that. And the only way they'd feel they absolutely had to is if we entered the war big time with bombs and everything else. I don't think we're going to do that. I think Trump has bought himself some time with his mercurial comment about 2 weeks. But I think in that 2 weeks, there could be effected some sort of return to diplomacy. But then you've got to ask yourself about Bibi, because he will not have gotten what he wanted. He will probably have trouble keeping his government together. And he may even go to jail. So what will he do to throw a monkey wrench in that if it does come about? I mean, he threw a pretty good monkey wrench in this one. But I don't agree. I do not agree with those who say Bibi talked Trump into doing this surprise attack or allowing him to do this surprise attack and even helping, as we're helping now, trying to defend Israel, but it's not working. I don't agree with that. I think we did it because we wanted to do it. I think it's part of this bigger picture where we want this arc of crisis all the way along the line where China's trying to penetrate. And the latest place, of course, that you know, I'm sure, that they're trying to penetrate is the railroad coming into that region of the world. And that's part of their base road initiative. So how do you stop that? Well, you eliminate the terminal, as it were. You eliminate Iran, or you eliminate the regime that tolerates that. I've asked the question a number of times of my colleagues, some of them at the Pentagon, what makes you think if you put Thomas Jefferson in charge of Iran and backed away from it, that they wouldn't have the same national security interests they have right now? And that is that they live in a very dangerous place in the world and they need weaponry in order to protect themselves. So would they be our poodle? No, they wouldn't be our poodle unless we put someone like the Shah's family back in there or some other tyrant that we could trust to be nothing but our poodle. That's the only way. And the Iranian, 90 million Iranian people wouldn't tolerate that. They would not tolerate that. They're not the Shah's people anymore. They're not necessarily the theocracy's people either. But if we bomb them, they will become the theocracy's people because we'll be bombing Persia. We'll be bombing Iran. And that's a very tough country, very tough. That's not Iraq. I've war planned for that country in the Zagros Mountains. That is a very, very difficult country to fight in. It almost killed Alexander the Great. That's the only place where he really came very close to dying, on the shores of the Persian Gulf. It's a tough country. So you don't want to fight there. You surely don't want to fight there if you don't have to. And we don't have to. So if we do, then the president is an idiot.
So the mainstream media here is claiming that the Iranians are dancing in the street. They just can't wait to be liberated. And the solution is regime change. Isn't regime change just taking Dracula out of the castle and replacing him with Frankenstein's monster?
That is probably what we would have if we put the Shah's descendants who are itching to get back in there. We certainly would have that. I think the situation right now is pretty equal. Iran has been pummeled No question about that. But Israel is now experiencing something they haven't since 1948. I've seen the videos. I've seen the people weeping in the street. I've seen the people lined up at psychiatric institutes and then get bombed even at the institute. I've seen the Microsoft building hit. I've seen the port of Haifa hit. I've seen a very important unit of the Israeli military almost utterly destroyed. I've seen a lot of missiles fall on Israel, and I've seen the interceptors running out of rockets. The last few missiles that have come in have not even been contested. And now they're firing that Oreshnik-like hypervelocity missile that no one has a defense against. And they fired several of them, and they've been effective. So, and they've got, I think, probably 50% of their rocket stores left. And Israel is almost out of interceptors. And we are sending people all across America to see if we can't create production lines. Lockheed Martin in particular, and its subsidiary Raytheon now, they bought Raytheon out, RTX, I think they call it, to see if they can't find other places where there are production lines that could be could accommodate, be converted to missile production lines. And they're not meeting too many people who want to do it for them. So we are hurting. We don't have the missiles to give to Israel, and Israel doesn't have the missiles to shoot at Iran's incoming missiles. It takes, you won't believe this, I didn't believe it when I saw it, and I'm a pilot. I saw the figures of JP-8 that were necessary to fuel a 200-plane strike several times repeated. We're talking about millions and millions of gallons of JP-8. Well, Haifa's just been taken out. That's the port where most of this oil comes in. So now most of the oil is coming by U.S. ship or tankers that the U.S. flags or rents, and then coming into wherever they can go into and offload that oil. But you burn up a lot of JP-8, which is jet fuel, when you do these kinds of strikes. So they're running out of things. Logistics is going to eat their lunch eventually. And Iran is, you know, operating on interior lines, really. They're not invading Israel. They're not in a sense of airplanes going to Israel all the time and everything. They're just sending rockets, and the rockets are already, they're there. They're already ready to go. And Israel did not destroy as many as they think they did. So it's leveling out in terms of who's winning and who's losing. Ultimately, though, I don't see how a country that is already branded in the world as a genocide creator, a genocide conductor, already branded in the world as coveting Syria so badly, it's extended its writ in Syria, already branded as a country that went into Lebanon and agreed in a ceasefire to remove its troops and is staying there because it wants their water. I don't think they'll leave Lebanon unless someone compels them to. This country is doing the U.S.'s bidding, no question about it. And I sometimes wonder who is whose poodle. But at the same time, the world is awakening to that fact, or at least they're awakening to the fact that Israel is not the country that it seemed to be or that it purports to be. So I don't think this is going to last very long in terms of Israel's survival. And if we want this to end, and to end in a way that doesn't bring us into it and end our empire along with Israel, and somehow wrest Israel out of the garbage and the refuse and keep it there as a state entity, we're going to have to negotiate this and not go to war ourselves. If we go out to war ourselves, we will probably end the state of Israel as a viable state and ourselves possibly along with it.
Could it escalate to the nuclear level?
It could. But here's a proposition I'll throw out at you. First of all, those big bombs, the GHQ, whatever they are, the Moab, you know, the B-2 delivered bombs, they will not do it. Everybody knows that. You know, Trump may be being told they will. They won't. They won't do it. One of them is a bomb that explodes, the one the B-2 brings in so dramatically, and we used it in Afghanistan. It brings it in, and it essentially is an incendiary. And it ignites the incendiary that gets dispensed, and it's very difficult to do. And the B-2 has to fly a perfect track and a perfect altitude, and it has to be just right. So if you wanted to shoot it down, you could shoot it down pretty easily. And Iran has the missiles to do that. So that's the problem with that one. The second one is the penetrator. And it can penetrate, and it has a pretty good whop to it, a conventional explosive. But Fordo is quite a few meters deeper than its penetration capability. So you're not going to do it with that. You might do a Houthi thing, you know, where you do it and then you lose. So what if you used a nuclear weapon? What if you used a low-yield nuclear weapon? Aside from the fact that that would be a first use since 1945 and a disaster, in my view, and we would have done it again, it probably wouldn't work. And here's the reason why. When we plan for putting MIRVed warheads, multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, that means a warhead has 8 to 10 of them in there. And each one of those 8 to 10 has the striking power, the explosive power of 100 times the bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. So that's a powerful missile coming in. We plan to put two of those missiles with 20 warheads on every single Russian silo were we to go to war with them to guarantee that we kill the missile inside the silo because they're buried deeply too. So think about this. We fly a 20 KT or even a half KT or a full KT nuclear weapon over Iran, drop it on Fordo, and nothing happens to the missiles or the facilities underneath. What do we look like then? Not only have we used a nuclear weapon again in the world, a taboo, but broken that taboo, but we also failed. Now, we wouldn't fail with the radioactivity and other things like that that might accrue and be disastrous for the Iranians in the area. But this is just pregnant with possibilities for making the empire look feckless.
So the domes then. What's your thoughts on the Iron Dome right now? And does that not bode well for America having a dome?
Certainly doesn't, because it is going to be astronomically expensive, multi-trillions of dollars, and it is not going to work. Bill Perry, who's the only engineer to ever be U.S. Secretary of Defense, toward the end of his secretariat, grew quite familiar with my Marine Corps War College, which I was in charge of at the time. And we used to go up and visit him periodically. We'd spend a couple of hours in his office in a seminar format. Bill was, as I said, an engineer. And he put it to me this way. We have never had in the history of trying, running back to about 1890 or so, in the history of trying to hit aerial targets with a ground weapon, we have never achieved more than 0.21 success rate. And I will guarantee you that if you're trying to hit a speeding bullet with a speeding bullet, your success rate will probably be below 0.21. So let's just envision 10 missiles coming in, each with a nuclear warhead, and you're able to take out two of them. Well, that's really good. That's two that won't go off. The other eight will. And you spend all that money for that ability to do that? Better that you spend the money on something else. And he wanted to spend it, of course, on conventional warfare. But when you look at it and you look at the physics, as Ted Postol, the retired professor emeritus from MIT, is always pointing out, he knows more about this than I. When you look at the physics of it, it's just too difficult. There's so many ways to thwart it. You send in dummies, which incidentally the Iranians are doing now. You send in dummies and cause the missiles to have to come out and, you know, they expend themselves. Or you just saturate the dome and enough of your missiles will get through to do the damage you want to do, because we're talking nuclear warheads here. And you don't need a whole lot of nuclear warheads to get through to do the damage that you want to, say, on New York City or Chicago or Houston or Los Angeles. And if you're using that as your counter deterrent, that's pretty persuasive, especially in a Western country where people don't take to that too much. Americans haven't seen any bombs falling on them in their whole life. We don't have anybody alive today other than a rare special forces person or whatever, or a person who's been in Afghanistan. 95% of Americans have never felt or been in an aerial attack. So just imagine if we had just a modicum of an aerial attack. People would be running all over the place, going to the psychiatrist tomorrow morning, like the Israelis are doing now, incidentally. So this business of air bombardment and domes, golden or otherwise, is just an attempt and I'm sad to say it often works to make money for the defense contractors and their shareholders. It is not a viable defense. The viable defense, as it were, was the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which my president, George W. Bush, abrogated single-handedly. That treaty said you must not build any kind of ballistic missile defense because then that will destroy the mutually assured destruction syndrome that we built very successfully. We didn't use them in the Cold War. And that treaty had some exceptions, like Moscow could build ballistic missile defense around Moscow, and we could build it around Washington if we wanted to, and we did. Because if you concentrate your defense at a specific spot, you can take out, as Bill would tell you, 8 out of the 10. And if you're trying to defend that specific spot and it's underground, let's say, then 8 out of 10 might be all you need to do. I mean, you might, you know, if 8 get through, they might not be enough to destroy your underground facility, like a command post in a mountain or something like that. But a lot of the ballistic missile defense that was even built during that time, when there were exceptions, was kind of like tongue in cheek. You know, we're going to spend this money and Lockheed's going to make a lot of money, but we really don't expect it to work. And you look at what's happening today with the Patriot missile system, for example, highly touted missile system. You look at what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening now in Israel and elsewhere, and you see all these missiles getting through because dummies are coming in and confusing them, because saturation tactics are being used and they get through. You just are foolhardy to spend this kind of money on this kind of system, which is not perfect nor even close. Because when you're talking nuclear weapons, stopping 6 out of 10 or even 5 out of 10 or even 7 out of 10, if the other 3 get through, you're still hurting badly. And look at all the money you spent, which you could have spent for other things. So I just think it's a boondoggle to make Lockheed Martin and its contractors richer, to make the shareholders' payments higher and the stock price higher. And Trump knows that. Trump knows that. I don't think he's dumb enough to where he doesn't realize that it's mostly for the stock market and for the defense contractors.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Yeah, and the stock market in Israel got hit as well, didn't it? So you touched on no attacks on home soil. And here in the UK, I think this is the longest we've gone without any war attacks on home soil. Do you sense complacency and perhaps parallels with the early last century, which led up to, you know, what happened with the big world wars?
I do. Colin Powell said to me when I first joined him in Atlanta, Georgia in 1989, I was a lieutenant colonel at the time and he was a 4-star general. So I, sir, he said, come into my office. I want to talk to you. And I went to his office and he sat me down. The first thing he said was, I'm going to give speeches, and the speeches I'm going to give are going to be the ones that kind of ask this question. What does a preacher do when the devil dies? I looked at him and said, what are you, a Baptist preacher or something? No, he said, no, you never heard that before. What does a preacher do when the devil dies? I said, Gorbachev asked me that question. Mikhail Gorbachev asked you that question? Yes, in St. Catherine's Palace. Okay, I get it. He was asking you, what are you going to do when the Soviets went away? That's what he was asking you. He said, yes. He actually said to me, I know you're a three-star general underneath that civilian coat, because that's what Powell was at the time. He was National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan. I know. I'm taking your enemy away. Your enemy is disappearing. So what are you going to do? So Powell is saying to me in Atlanta, Georgia, he's saying, I'm going to give speeches that the devil is dead. And we're going to have to pay the American people back a dividend. We're going to have to cut the Army and cut the Navy and cut the Air Force and pay the American people back a dividend because the Cold War is over. And he was one of the first people to begin saying that, 1989, all to lead to the fact that everything we did during that administration with George H.W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Edward Shepard Nazi, Mikhail Gorbachev, Helmut Kohl, Francois Mitterrand, John Major, and Maggie Thatcher, everything we did, we tossed out with Bill Clinton. Completely tossed it out and said, nope, we need a new Cold War. Where's our enemy? We picked China. Russia came along after Putin took charge. We thought we'd done, you know, with Yeltsin, we thought we'd done Russia in. We thought we'd done them in with Anatoly Chuba and Larry Summers, who went to Moscow and conducted the fire sales that sold everything from the old Soviet Union, like the oil rights, to the oligarchs. And they made millions, if not billions, off the fees they charged for doing that. So Putin saw that. Putin saw that. He saw the rape of the Soviet Union orchestrated by the United States financial system and London's financial system. They were right there, too. Germany was there also. He had, you know, this feeling about, wow, that's not what they probably should have been doing. So that's where I think Putin began to develop his attitude about the West being deceitful and that sort of thing. Ukraine has just ramified that for him. I'm not saying Putin's an angel. I'm just saying that he is a realpolitiker, and he's not going to take that sort of thing. As well, he shouldn't. It's his country. So we're looking at a situation that we've developed over the years, and now we have a circus clown as our president with somewhere around 80 to 100 billionaires advising him in the background, about a third of whom are dual citizens, is Israel and America. And they're making him make the decisions that he's making when he does, in fact, make a decision, and not the National Security Council, not the statutory process, not the Congress, not anyone else who's supposed to be helping him make decisions, not even using his cabinet. These people are responsible, I think, for what's happening right now in Southwest Asia, for example. Wasn't Netanyahu that egged Trump into doing this? Netanyahu was their instrument, if you will, from time to time. But it's the people that are around Trump advising him. We call them neoconservatives a lot, but they're worse than neoconservatives. A lot of them are neoconservatives, card-carrying neoconservatives, but a lot of them are also this group that believes that the leadership of the United States ought to be passed to a technocratic board, and that there ought to be a CEO of that board, and there ought to be a COO, and there ought to be vice presidents. And they want to be those people, of course. And they want to run the country as if it were an executive office place and a corporation, a limited liability partnership, whatever you want to call it. That's the way they want to run the country. And people think I'm crazy when I say that. Watch what happens. January the 6th in this country did not fail because our system held. It failed because the coup plotters were incompetent. They will not be incompetent the second time around.
So if the neocons have a perpetual need for war, hypothetically speaking, if Iran was bombed by America, what country would America be looking to bomb next for the benefit of the neocons?
That's a good question. I don't think it would be a situation we would confront, though. I think this, were we to enter this war in a significant way, were Iran to attack our facilities in the region, which I think would be concomitant, you'd be seeing the beginning of the unraveling of the American empire. And with it, the diminishment of the Western Hemisphere to nothing more than a vassal, if you will, for think of the relationship between Britain and ultimately America and China during the open door policy. Think of it in reverse, with us being the open door and China being the perpetrator of the track shoes on our back. I don't think it would get that way, because I don't look at China as being that kind of state. But I do think it would be a real reversal of present circumstances. And we would be in the Western Hemisphere, particularly beleaguered, because we would not be a participant in the more dynamic money creating, economy creating, trade creating, education, you know, of the world. We'd be a backwater. And that's sort of what history screams might happen, I think, if you look at the long stretch, except for the fact that we're all facing the nuclear arms race, and that might end us completely. And we're all facing the climate crisis, which indeed, over a longer period of time, might give us some real existential problems. Nuclear weapons trouble me in particular, because we, the empire, America, have discarded every painstakingly arrived at treaty that we achieved during the long Cold War. Every single one of them. The only one that remains is a sort of new development, a good development, new start. And it goes out in February of 26. And I would be very surprised if Putin agreed to renew it. Instead, they're building, China's building, Pakistan's building, India's building. We're building, we're going to create a $2 trillion new world of nuclear weapons that will, now here's the kicker, give us the ability to conduct a first strike and win. That's the ultimate objective of this $2 trillion new nuclear weapons development program. We want to be able to strike first and win. No one will tell you that, but that's what it is.
So I'm watching gold and oil creep up, but the stock market seems to be holding up as well. Do you think the stock market is holding up because they believe that Trump's better business instincts will prevail?
I think they're holding up mainly because they're making a lot of money, especially those people who know what he's going to do with one tariff on Monday and another tariff on Tuesday and the one he did on Monday on Thursday, because they're making a lot of money off these rises and falls of the stock market. The stock market is really not much of an indicator. The bond market is the indicator. And the bond market is giving off signs that things are getting bad. We will have a $50.2 trillion aggregate debt in just 8 years, says the Congressional Budget Office. We have a $32 trillion aggregate debt right now. Our interest payments on that debt are $1 trillion U.S. annually. The CBO report says there'll be $2 trillion annually very shortly, about 7 years. That means that there will be no discretionary federal spending whatsoever, zero. That means the budget every year will go for defense and fixed payments. No discretionary spending whatsoever. So we're headed for a fiscal crisis of the first order, maybe even worse than the Great Depression in the 30s. So the empire's not looking too good. The empire is on shaky legs.
And is that one of the things that upset Elon, that all of his money he had saved was handed over to the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex? And the debt increased?
Yeah, I do think that is one aspect of it. I think another aspect of it was he saw just how bad it is. And frankly, he didn't know what to do about it. And so he got into a spat with Donald, because Donald didn't want any of that getting out for political reasons. I think they've patched it up now, but I think he's still smarting from the fact that he ran up against the beast and he didn't run. I think he had an image of the beast, but he had no idea what it was capable of and what its dimensions really were. And that shocked him.
Viewers, we're coming up to the hour, so please get your final questions in. for Colonel Wilkerson. And one of the questions is, with the inland drone attacks in Russia and the inland drone attack in Iran, did you see parallels as if they've been designed by the same intelligence?
Yes, MI6, CIA, and Mossad. Both, the pattern is there. Here's the unique thing about Israel's. They used principally Afghans, and they started recruiting them years ago. Disgruntled Afghans who've always had on that border a particular gripe with Iranians and Iranians with them. They used them by recruiting them, training them, getting them acculturated, if you will, crossing the border into Iran, which is pretty easy to do. We forget Iran had, Israel's about the size of Greater London, right? Iran is a huge country. I mean, it's a huge, and it's got a border that's so long that they have trouble with thieves crossing the border, with illegal traders. So these Afghans came into Iran and they infiltrated the populations and they became a part of the population of northern Iran. And then they did their business when Israel called on them to do it. So yes, there are parallels in terms of the drones used and the way they used them and how they infiltrated, but it was a little bit longer term plan by Israel. Think of the cell phones. Remember the cell phones that exploded? That was a long term plan that Israel put in motion and then activated when they wanted to. Well, that's kind of the way this was. It was always there. If they went to war with Iran, they were going to activate it, and they did. Now, the Iranians have captured most of these Afghans, and their life expectancy is very short.
And do you think that with what happened in Iraq, Iran has been preparing for an attack from America for years?
I think a certain number of them, probably the IRGC in particular, the leadership, which has now been pretty much assassinated, but they're junior people there will take over, I'm sure. Maybe the Security Council, some in the Majlis, they've always been wary. The remarkable thing is, I think, even with this government right now, they want a better relationship with America. They do. They would prefer the devil they know. I should put that differently. They should prefer, they prefer the devil they don't know that well to the devil they do know. And they know Russia really well. They have a long history with bad relations with Russia and Britain, enormous history with bad relations with Britain, going all the way back to Britain's trying to, you know, essentially capture all the oil fields and take all the money and everything else. So they still have, even with all that's happened, they still have a fairly positive attitude towards the American people, not towards our government, no way towards our government, but towards the American people. And they think the American people, by and large, are being hornswoggled by their own government. And that if the American people really had a democracy and really, really had their voice felt, they'd be more sympathetic to the Iranian situation. There's some truth to that too, probably. So they're, I think they're still holding out. They're still on that cusp of belief that that country thousands of miles away is a better country to be associated with economically, trade-wise, security-wise, and such than Russia on top of them or China around the corner. But they could be changed out of that attitude very quickly, especially if we do something really, really stupid, which there's the potential for us to do.
So Basil wants to know whether Trump is losing his mind. And it's a strange situation, isn't it? Because when Kennedy tried to assert himself over the military and intelligence, he got killed. There was these assassination attempts on Trump himself. But now the vested interests that many people are behind those assassinations and attempts are getting in the way. It's almost as if, you know, Trump's like the emperor, and but he's of Rome, and his military is just running amok for the vested interest in the shadows, and he's trying to save face. What do you think is going through his mind? Because it's a lot to deal with, isn't it? Assassination attempts. You say you're the peace president. Next thing, a war is getting foisted on you by the deep state.
It's a remarkable situation in many in many respects. I'm almost 81 years old, and I never thought I would see anything like this in my lifetime. The historian in me says, well, you were stupid then. The empires don't last forever. But it is a strange situation that Trump was elected. Boggles my mind that we have 340 million roughly people, of whom 200 million maybe are eligible registered voters, and that 70 or so million of them voted for Donald Trump as opposed to 60 or so for the other guy, and 50 or 60 million of them didn't vote at all. That's not a democracy. That's a strange warp and woof beneath a democratic patina, but it's not a democracy. So how did he get there? How did he recognize that situation, not once, but twice, and use it to win the Oval Office? I mean, that, or did he? Was it the people around him? Was it the people around him that saw an opportunity to rule and perhaps rule for a long time, and put him out as their front man? I don't know. I tend to believe the latter.
So Tracy wants to know, how come some countries can have nuclear weapons and others can't?
That's a good question. If you are willing to sign up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to the Safeguards Agreement, and to the Additional Protocol, and accept the IAEA inspections routinely, you should be allowed to have a nuclear program, which would be defined by the parameters of your petition, as well as what was allowed by the international community. That's the key word, by the international community, not by the empire, but by the international community. The problem is the international community has been infiltrated by the empire. This last minute IAEA report on Iran, it was totally orchestrated by Washington and London. Let's get it out there at the time that we know something's coming, so let's get it out there. And the reality of it is the IAEA is infiltrated with Mossad, MI6, CIA. I know that because I had to deal with them when we were dealing with Iraq. And there's even the ignominious possibility that the IAEA, when it tendered that damaging report on the eve of war almost, had given Israel the coordinates of the key nuclear facilities so they could bomb them. And I don't doubt that for a minute, that it actually came from the IAEA. Okay, you need these specific coordinates. Here they are. We just got them. I don't know. But I do know that we've corrupted the international mechanism badly, too. The OPCW, the IAEA, the inspectors in Iraq, things like that. I think Hans Blix was the one person in that apparatus that I saw that I thought was pretty damned honest. And he was straightforward, and he was telling the truth when he knew the truth. It was too bad Colin Powell didn't trust him more. So the empire is going to contaminate whatever it touches. We had a great candidate for Secretary General of the UN. Her name was Helen Clark. You may have heard of her. She was from New Zealand. And she was a undersecretary who cleaned up all the corruption in her area of responsibility, got everything organized like a good ship. She was a brilliant administrator, and she was fearless, and she had courage. She was in the line for Secretary General. We made sure she didn't get it.
So Kelly wants to know, if you were in Trump's position right now, what would you do?
Let's just say that I'm right where he is right now. I would never have gotten us here, but if I were right where he is right now, I'd leave that message hanging out there that there was 2 weeks, 10 days, whatever it is now. And about midway in that, if the Iranians made the proper agreement with me, and I think you could get them to, we go back into negotiations and the wars would stop and Netanyahu would be put in his cage. And maybe we would even get him to stop what he's doing in Gaza, at least to the extent that he's doing it. And during that time, we would also negotiate an agreement that included Iran's ability to enrich to 3.76% or whatever it is. And everybody would be not happy, but they would be content to go back and exercise their rights under those agreements until they could make a better deal and there'd be no more war. But that's pipe dreaming. I mean, I don't think Trump's capable of that. I hope he is, but I don't think he is. And then you've got to say, would the Iranians do that, given that they've now been blooded so badly, even though they bloodied Israel too, and you could call it a draw. I'm not sure they'd do that.
So Agent Orange wants to know, are the new generations of young people ready to be drafted? I mean, here in this country, Keir Starmer is talking about sending our young people to Ukraine.
Good luck in this country. I'll tell you what would happen if we declared a draft tomorrow morning. One, by law, we'd have to include women. And two, the youngsters in the 18 to 24-year-old range who are draftable will go to Mexico and Canada. We'd be looking at the same problem Ukraine has. We'd have to send vans around the country with goon squads to pluck the kids out of their beds and hit them over the head with a ball peen hammer and wake them up in uniform. That's the truth. That's about how much. I don't blame them. I've done the polling. The number one answer was me sign up for a force that's going to go to some foreign country and kill people for nothing more than money. That's what we've done to our youth.
I've watched the videos in Ukraine where they're just snatching kids off the streets.
Yes. Yes. We called it impressment in the old days. You know, we've been there before. We had majors and captains who would go to Boston. This is 1870, 1875. Go to Boston, drag the Irish off the ship they came in on, hit them over the head. They'd wake up in the saddle and fill Sheridan's Army of the West a week later. So we've done that before. I'm telling you, today it would be impossible to conscript without major force.
Sid wants to know whether you think Netanyahu will be charged with war crimes, and doesn't Netanyahu have an incentive just to keep things escalating to hide his own sins?
Well, Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir, I think, and Smotrich have already been charged with war crimes. And all we're waiting for is someone with the courage to arrest them and bring them to The Hague.
Wow. So, Missy, my son served as a Marine, 21, lost 9 of his brothers out of 13. He's considered disabled. Could he be called back up?
Wow, is this in England or
in the States?
In the States,
I think. Yeah.
Technically speaking, yes. I'm callable back up. I'm vulnerable till I'm 85 as an officer. Now, enlisted man's a little bit different, but as an officer, we actually brought an 84-year-old engineer back on service in the Navy, took the ship out of the James River fleet from World War II, refurbished the ship, and he made 2 transits to the Gulf for Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm, the first Gulf War. And he did a great job. We gave him a medal afterwards for being the oldest person.
Well, that's a lighter note to finish this on, Larry. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion to the viewers? And thank you again for spending this time with us.
No, I will say this. I hope nothing that I've said that is draconian and awful comes true.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go and close the show. So you take care, my friend. Get some rest. And we'll be looking out for your other broadcast. Cheers.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. All right. Good night. Bye. What a fantastic guest, folks. And that ends the war coverage for today. But we've got Dan Welch joining us at 6 p.m. UK tomorrow. And then we've got Ray McGovern join us at 8 p.m. tomorrow. And Shane's already got more guests lined up for Sunday. So thank you for contributing to the chat and the questions. And thank you, mods. Hope to see some of all y'all in the streams tomorrow. So have a good evening.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.